Welcome to the Colors of Relationships podcast. I'm your host, Cedric Weatherspoon, licensed marriage and family therapist.
And I'm Dr. Asia King, licensed professional clinical counselor. Thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the show.
If you're looking to start your own podcast, Buzzsprout is the perfect place to start. If you follow the link on our link tree, once you get a paid plan, you also will get a $20 Amazon gift card. The team at Buzzsprout is definitely passionate about helping you succeed, and they make sure that your show gets listed on every podcast platform. Since we've used Buzzsprout, we're available on Spotify, Apple, truly anywhere that you can think, and we definitely have seen a turnaround in our amount of listeners. So if you're ready to get started and knock out that podcast that's been going around in your head, head over to our link tree, follow our affiliate link, and be sure to sign up for Buzzsprout today.
Hi, and welcome to the Colors of Relationships. I am your host, Dr. Asia King, along with
Cedric Weatherspoon.
And we have a wonderful guest today, my personal friend from Birmingham, Alabama. Oh, I want to cry. We have my friend and my homeboy, Chad Hewlett, who is coming on so graciously to just talk to us about anything and everything in between. And I'm super excited, man. This Chad is so dope, y'all. And I'm not just saying that as just because, like, he's my homie from way back, but, like, Chad is so knowledgeable and just so smart, and he could talk about anything and everything in between. Like, there's never a dull moment. Like, I think we even had to catch ourselves today, like, a little bit on Facebook on, like, we ain't gonna touch that topic kind of deal, right? But Chad is awesome and so amazing, and I wanted him to be the first part of our kickoff for Black History Month. So, Chad, you're, like, our first Black History Month guest.
Oh, wow. I'm honored. Thank you guys so much. I am Chad Hewlett. I am the Director of Communications for our CBG, which is a community business and government. That's what CBG stands for. You can check us out at www.ourcbg.com. Essentially, what we do is we work with a lot of non-government organizations, nonprofits, and various entities in and around the Southeast for right now, nationwide coming soon. And we work with them to administer various contracts and to make sure they get the word out about their various programs. For example, there is I better not talk about that one. Okay. But for example, let's say the state of Alabama wanted to roll out the COVID vaccine and wanted to make sure that the people in the Black Belt, which for those of you that don't know, is an economically depressed but very soil rich area that runs through Mississippi all the way up to South Carolina, but it's very, very prevalent in Alabama. It's a very impoverished area, low education. It's just fascinating. But if you want to kind of get the word out to them that the COVID vaccine can be gotten here or there, we have various tools, and we have the smartest team that I've ever worked with in life to kind of make those kind of things happen. Essentially, what we do is we stand at the intersection of the community, business, and government to make sure that our people are properly represented, and to also make sure that we're not being patronized when certain entities try to talk to us. So that's kind of my job.
So really, your job is to make sure that those communities that don't have access to resources, you help bridge the gap.
That's essentially what we're kind of becoming. That's essentially becoming our bread and butter, our niche. We really enjoy that kind of work as a team. We have other endeavors that we work on and other things that we do. But as a team, what we really enjoy is that minority impoverished group outreach, because we come from those areas. We come from that background. I can't think of a person on the team that is not intimately familiar with, you know, the ills of poverty and the ills of abject poverty at that, living in what's supposed to be a first world country. So, matter of fact, the owner of the company is from Fairfield. And Fairfield is what? On the verge of bankruptcy right now.
Right, right. And so for those of you who don't know, Fairfield is part of like that Birmingham sector, the Birmingham Jefferson County piece. And when you think, if anybody has ever been to Birmingham, Alabama, but Birmingham has so much culture, so much history. Mm-hmm. I mean, we are, I always like to say Birmingham is the heart of the civil rights movement. It is the heart of every story you ever hear. All the great leaders have passed through Birmingham. So when we're talking about Fairfield, you know, it's part of that history, but yet it does not reflect, you know, the richness of, you know, what Birmingham is all about and, you know, how we have supposedly overcome all the obstacles that we face. So, wow. So he is spearheading that. Yeah. And that's amazing.
Could you talk we have an international audience. So could you speak a little bit about the history of the Black Belt, you know, for our international listeners?
So the Black Belt is a very rural area. Agriculture back in the day was the primary source of income for most of the families down there. Think slavery, essentially. If you think slavery, that's where it was most prevalent in the state of Alabama throughout the Black Belt, because the soil was rich. You could grow peanuts. In Alabama, you could actually grow tobacco in certain places. While that's more known up in Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, you could actually grow tobacco because of the richness of the soil, that deep, dark soil, the black soil that was there. But it was also very much filled with black people as a result of that horrible Holocaust that we experienced for 400 years that we know as chattel slavery. And so it's one of those things where the Black Belt became synonymous not only with the rich soil, but also black people. So you think about Lowndes County. Most of us have heard of the Black Panther Party. Well, the Black Panther Party got the Panther from the Lowndes County Freedom Organization in the Black Belt. And actually, my great uncle, Sheriff John Hewlett, there's a story that says that one of the guys that was leading the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, when he woke up in the morning, he like, oh, Black Panther. And so as a joke, they put the Panther on the sign, and it grew into an international movement of Black Panthers. That's one of those stories in Alabama that you don't hear.
Wow.
But it was really at the epicenter of every single forceful movement for equal and civil rights in this country. Speaking more about the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, it was one of the first major pushes by a major black organizations coming together in the Southeast to register black folks to vote, when they had the voting tests and the voting taxes and the grandfather clauses that were keeping us out of the voting booth. So the Black Belt is a very historic, rich in folklore and history area. It's a beautiful place. The people are beautiful. I'm not gonna move down there because I like the city, but
come on, we gotta populate the country too.
Let me ask you this, Chad. So, you know, a lot of times when you describe the Black Belt like that, you know, you and I, we come from that area. That is us. You know, some of us ran so far away from Alabama, you know, ran so far away from the South. What kept your passion there? What kept your passion to help, you know?
Well, so I actually right now I'm living in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I actually came to North Carolina when I was in the military, and I fell in love, you know, had my son, moved to Charlotte, but my son ended up staying with his mom somewhere else because she said, I'm not coming. So, no, it was great. She's amazing. Let me not say it like that.
Absolutely. Yes, she is.
I love her tremendously, her and her husband. Her husband's an amazing guy, and I love them both tremendously. But I'm actually moving back to Birmingham in March for a short stay. Want to do some things, want to get some things going. If you didn't know, I'm the producer of the podcast for the city of Birmingham, the Magic City Spotlight. And actually, this last episode, I got to host it with another one of our friends, Asia, Deontay Gordon.
Oh, yeah. Deontay, who's moving and shaking in Birmingham. I mean, amazing.
He's the CEO of Tech Birmingham, and they're recruiting new tech industry partners and talent to Birmingham to make Birmingham a tech hub of the Southeast. But to answer your question, I have a daughter, 11-year-old daughter, my Princess Mackenzie, and she lives in Birmingham. My parents live in Birmingham. I have a really unique upbringing that I won't quite go into because we don't have enough time. But my entire family, both of my families, live essentially in Alabama. And Alabama, while it didn't offer me everything that I wanted, when I left 12 years ago, it gave me everything I needed to succeed as I moved out. And so a couple of years ago, my buddy Lindsay, the one that's from Fairfield that owns CBG, he reached out to me and said, "Hey, man, you know, I started this company. I need some help." I said, "So what are you doing?" And he told me at the time he was working primarily with the city of Birmingham and essentially the campaign to elect our current mayor, Randall Whitfield. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with Randall. I know Randall. And I'm like, "That's good for the city. Let me help out." And so I helped him out. And we just, the next thing came up and the next thing came up and the next thing came up. And I would go home and I'm like, "Man, the city is really growing. It's getting beautiful. Like, I'm starting to get homesick." And so this last time I went home, my mom said, "Well, you know, you can always move down here.
You always can come down here."
Isn't that the whole Southern open door thing that your parents, I'm from Florida. So that open door, just open invitation. It's like, you can leave, but you can always come back home. That's huge.
I think that's indicative of the South all over as a geographical area. And there's a difference in being Black from the South and being raised other places. And I'm sure people on the West Coast will say that, people in the Midwest, people in the Northeast will say the same thing. But there's something about being Black and Southern. I'm always fascinated when I go to these HBCUs, which are primarily all throughout the South. The state of Alabama, fun fact, has the most HBCUs of any state in the country. So that's a fun fact for you guys. But you go to these HBCUs and you find these people from California, Nevada, Washington, Oregon, Black folks coming from New York, Wisconsin, all kinds of places. And it's just so fascinating because they come to the South. It's one of those things where, like, when my mama said, "Baby, you can always come home," the entire culture down here says, no matter where you may have spread out in this country, if you come back to the South, baby, you home.
Yes.
Home. Except don't go to Atlanta because Atlanta's full.
They ain't taking no more folks. But no. That's true, Chad. I mean, because if you think about it, you know, like I said, Birmingham, Alabama in itself, there's just so much rich history there that you have folks where, I mean, I have folks that were born in Chicago, Minnesota, and it's like, in order to experience Blackness, you go South.
You go home.
So you're absolutely right. But I want to circle back to something. You said you were in the military and government, and these are all popping words. It with that respect, and all of the news and, you know, our recent elections, I mean, oh my goodness, I can only imagine what your walls would have to, what that fly on the wall would have to say about your conversations around elections and Trump and everything else. Where do we start? Because I want to hear your voice on all of that.
So here's what I'll say. I am a political centrist. And that's in the truest sense of the word. I believe, you know, love is love. And personally, I don't, and this, so it's certain topics that I don't have an opinion on, which makes me lean left. For example, gay marriage. I don't plan on marrying a man, so I don't really care. But I think gay people should have the right to be just as miserable as all the other married folks I know. So that's just how I look at it, you know?
Equal opportunity, baby.
Yeah, abortions. Look. I can't have a baby to come out of my area, right? And I don't know whether abortion is right or wrong. But what I do know is that a 75-year-old white man shouldn't be telling a 22-year-old black woman on the south side of Chicago what to do with her body.
There you go.
I do know that. I like guns, which makes me lean right. I like guns a lot. I have quite a few firearms, but that's also me being a Southern country boy. So I love guns. I'm also very pro-military. I am a third generation veteran. Me, my grandfather, and my father were all combat vets. I went to Iraq. My father went to Vietnam. And my grandfather was in World War II.
Oh, wow.
My grandfather came home and started his own business because he said, you know, he couldn't go over there and be treated with such respect and come home and go on a job and have somebody disrespect him. So it's one of those things. I come from a very proud lineage of folks who know how to fight, but also know how to, you know, get out there and be involved and handle business. So it's one of those things where when I think about politics and me being a centrist, this last election cycle, I wasn't excited or enthused about it. Mm-hmm. I'll say that much. Well, it's because, so with the Biden-Harris ticket, I was ecstatic for Kamala Harris. Mm-hmm. Okay. I think Kamala Harris is amazing. Joe Biden, I can appreciate, you know, him trying to atone for some of his past missteps. I really do appreciate Joe, the evolution, so to speak, of Joe Biden. And to kind of, you know, bring it back to Black culture, the re-education of Joe Biden, so to speak. So I can really appreciate that transition. I appreciate Simone Sanders, who did so much to make sure that that campaign did its thing. I appreciated the inauguration. I appreciated seeing, you know, Jordans on the stage. I am superheads. I appreciate that completely. You know, we brought the culture to the Capitol, so it was beautiful to me. So I just think about all that stuff, and then I think about the other side. And I think about what we saw the week before the inauguration, where we saw a large group of disenchanted, disaffected, predominantly white individuals who we like to label uneducated and poor. But let me tell you this, the body armor, the weapons, the tactical gear, that stuff is expensive. Right. And it's coming out more and more that these are not the poor people. These are your real estate agents. These are your doctors, your lawyers, your politicians. Shout out to Ted Cruz and Lauren, what's her name? Bobo, whatever her name is. No, but it's one of those things, like, you saw this and we've seen this before. We've seen this massive movement of white angst on the Capitol before, but except they wore white sheets and hoods. And this was less than 100 years ago. And people urge us to forget so much. And it's like, I'm looking at this, it's like a tale of two countries from one week to the next. And it's like, these people are angry because they feel they're being pushed out of something that they're entitled to. And these people are, you know, hopeful and tearful about finally getting a small sliver of a piece of that American dream that they were promised. And it's fascinating how I, as a Black man, fit into this. And how you, Asia, as a Black woman, fit into this. Because I think about how many of my brothers supported the right wing side, supported that side of folks who were, you know, attacking the Capitol and the very foundation of our democracy. And it made me wonder for a short period of time. Like, I think a lot of the reason that so many men supported Trump was because, you know, the bluster and the bravado and the unapologetic hypermasculinity that we saw all the time, the, you know, I'm always right, you know, type thing. It was one of those things where people thought he was assertive and strong. And it's one of those things where I'm looking at it like, what are you guys seeing? Like, I don't understand what you guys are seeing. But you have to also think about the fact that this is not an intellectual assessment. It's an emotional one. And so when these Black men were like, shoot, man, you know, Trump trying to make sure the economy good, and the only way that we gonna get right is get the money right. I'm like, so here's my thing. I don't care about my 401k so much as I care about my humanity being respected. That money isn't going to do me any good if I'm allowed to be legally lynched. You know, it doesn't matter. And to go back to the Black Belt, you think about it, all those Black folks during Reconstruction, some of them were able to buy land. What happened to that land? It was taken from them. There have been Black millionaires in Atlanta since Reconstruction. What happened to those millionaires? They were murdered. And so it's one of those things where you look at it and it's like, is history really repeating itself, or have we even evolved?
Yes, I always believe that. You know, with all of this, you know, I tend to step back from things when I look at chaos, you know, and that's the therapist in me. You know, it seems like, you know, this is not new stuff. This is old. If you research and see the history behind how, you know, the rich landowners manipulate the middle class whites and the blacks and pitted us against each other, you know, the playbook looks the same. It's just paint, it's in a different cover. And so, you know, I always say, you know, I grew up in fresh off the butt of the civil rights movement. That's my era. And I understand, like, I've seen the Klan get dismantled and Alabama get sued so bad that it dismantled the Klan. And I think this stuff is just, it was in the plans the whole time that, you know, you separate and you come together again and you refocus and you come back to the table again. But I think it's people better wake up and see what's really going on. These aren't games. I always think these aren't games we're playing. This stuff is real, and you know, you have to really pay attention to what's going on, or it'll get out of control quick. And we have seen that throughout history, where you kind of brush things off and say, yeah, you know, it ain't that bad. You know, we can handle it. We're strong. And all of a sudden, you're in a serious situation. So far as the black men supporting Trump and not really seeing it from the perspective of our children and what's our interest. Do you feel like we really pounded down? I know a group of us understand what our interests are. What about the folks who just the regular old people, the people from the black belt and people just living day to day? Do they really understand what our interest is?
Yes and no. The more nuanced details of it, no. There's so much nuance in terms of everything that black people need and want in this country politically and what we ask for but have not yet demanded. Let's make this be clear about the difference. I think that, you know, everybody essentially wants the same thing. We want safety. We want security. We want money in our pocket. We want our kids to be well educated. But a lot of times we don't know the apparatus by which those things happen. So that's why I say no, because a lot of people don't know the apparatus by which that happens. But they know essentially what we want because they live with it every day. They live at the mercy of others' excess sometimes every day. They live at the bottom of the totem pole in capitalism every day. And so it's one of those things that they know what they need. And so it's a matter of I'm going to vote for who gives me what I need or who wants what I need to be in my hands, as opposed to somebody who's telling me to go out and get it without providing me an opportunity to. So that's I think that's the difference. I think that's what we see.
I think what's shocking for me is that I didn't even know that black men had such. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, when the polls came out and they were able to kind of break it up by, you know, gender and race. And I remember doing like a double take. And I was like, wait a minute, more black men were in support over, I think it was like even white men or even white. It was like over.
I think it was at a certain age group and income level or something.
Right. It was something. But I didn't expect it to be so high. Yeah. And it felt like it just came from out of nowhere. And my group is not black men. My group is just women and with a few speck of men, with Cedric being one of them, mm-hmm. and my dad maybe being the other.
That's so, two. So and was, three to Chad.
Yeah.
And my boys, right? So what I realized was that my circle, one, isn't big. It's not big. Two, I felt like I was missing out on that pivotal conversation on why did our men, you know, really connect with the ideal of what Trump was saying? What do you think that was about, Chad?
So I believe that it was two things, essentially. I think that, you know, the drum started getting beat that Joe Biden has been in office all this time and hadn't done anything for y'all. And, you know, the Democrats take you for granted. And I'll be clear, you know, I kind of agree. You know, I kind of agree that we are our vote is absolutely taken for granted and has been for about 30 years or so now, if not longer. So that was part of it. But also there was a turning point that I saw on social media where I saw more black men talking about Trump. And that was when the whole thing went down with the contract with Black America and Ice Cube. when he reached out to the Biden-Harris campaign as well as the Trump-Pence campaign, and the Trump and Pence folks sat down with him, whereas the Biden-Harris campaign attempted to, you know, put him into a call with other entertainers like Snoop Dogg and Kevin Hart and stuff like that.
Right.
And he wasn't feeling that. Now, I completely understand why the Democratic Party operatives did that, because I understand that Cube had come up with this wonderful contract that he got all these educated folks to put together. But at the same time, Cube is an absolute novice in the political arena. And it's one of those things like, come on, bro, like, we can put you here and we're going to listen to you. We're giving you an opportunity to be here, but we can't automatically put you in the same category as all these other folks who have been doing this for 15 years.
Right.
You know, and so I get it. But at the same time, on the outside, the optics look really, really bad.
Yeah.
And so I noticed that some black men were just like, dang, at least Trump hearing us out, at least Trump giving us a chance. They just trying to run with it and do this. Now, there's also an undercurrent currently that I've noticed, and I dare not speak in absolutes here. But I think that we look at how the Democratic Party is basically carried by black women. You know, Atlanta got a mayor named Keisha. You know what I'm saying? You got Simone Sanders. You got Kamala Harris. You got all these amazing black women, and black women vote by and large to save this country from time to time. And some black men feel disaffected and left out because you look at black women being the fastest growing demographic of folks who are being educated, the fastest rising earnings in the country. And, you know, black women are getting love and black men feel left behind. A lot of black men feel left behind. And I didn't really understand the thought process. And I still don't understand the thought process, to be very clear, until the debate, and this is going to go completely left, until the debate about R. Kelly and Bill Cosby.
What?
Hear me out. This is my Malcolm Gladwell moment. All right, I'm about to tie it back in.
There you go.
So we saw Bill Cosby face accusations from roughly 60 women. And people said, well, nah, you know, they lying on him, or they knew what they was trying, they were getting into, yada, yada, yada. I'm like, okay, so let's say 2/3 of them are lying. Let's be clear. So it's 20 women. So 20 women lying? So let's say it's 83% of them are lying. That's still 10 women. So how many is enough for you to believe these women, number one? And then with R. Kelly, I read Jim DeRogatis's expose on R. Kelly like over a decade ago, and I thought he was a creep, and I have not listened to R. Kelly since then. And if R. Kelly wasn't doing this to poor black women, he would have been under the jail a long time ago. And so when R. Kelly, you know, finally got, you know, just a little bit of his comeuppance, you know, the first battle cry that I heard from the R. Kelly supporters was, well, what about Harvey Weinstein?
Right.
He got away with it. What about Elvis? Y'all gonna cancel Elvis? What about, you know, what's his name? Charlie Sheen. I'm like, Charlie, where the hell that come from? You know, all that stuff. What about Matt Lauer? I'm like, come on, y'all. Okay. So it's one of those things like, so what you're telling me is that you want these two black men, one, because he gave you a certain idea about black excellence as a child, and one, because you want to do Step in the Name of Love at your family reunion, you want them to get the same treatment as these rich white guys, when A, we know the justice system is not set up for us to win, and B, you're not even paying attention to what's going on with those white guys' lives and the punitive things that they're suffering from. So what you want is privilege. You don't want justice. You don't want equity. You don't want freedom. You want the same type of privilege that you see in your everyday lives. So when you go to work and your boss, who's possibly a white man, considering, you know, population demographics and average black income level, you see him come in and he can get away with stuff that you can't get away with. You want that privilege. You want the ability to go into a bank. And I'm not mad at this specifically, but you want the ability to go into a bank and have a half-assed business plan and walk out with $100,000.
Yeah. Yes, I would love to do that. I'll take that, please, sir.
Whereas me, myself, I just want this dude to have to put the same due diligence in it to it as I do.
Right.
That's equity. That's justice. That's freedom. I don't want his privilege. I want us all to be free and to be, you know, because I don't feel like there's a person on the planet who is better than me. But the problem is that we have this inferiority complex sometimes as a culture that causes us to become the biggest white supremacists in the country. We begin advocating for white supremacist ideals because we want what they have sometimes in terms of cultural currency, cultural relevancy, and all that kind of stuff. And so
is white supremacy normalized? That's why we look at it from that point of view.
Yeah.
It's like that's the norm. So, of course, yeah, we want to get away with stuff, too. You know, and so speaking about you got into economics. So I'm going to push. I'm going to get you over there. I know you like going there. But, you know, it's always this talk about reparations and how is that going to be distributed and all of that other stuff. And people want to hold Joe Biden to the fire and say, we want our reparations. We want our just due. We want to catch up. So what are your thoughts on that? And you know, in general, what's your thoughts on reparations?
So I actually posted this on Facebook the other day. I wasn't necessarily a fan of reparations until probably the last 4 years or so. There's no way you can watch the Netflix documentary Crack and not be an advocate for reparations. When you take the timeline of the history of black folks in this country, right? You have 400 years of slavery from 1619. Well, excuse me. You have 200 plus years of slavery. You have 1619 in Jamestown, Virginia, when the first slave stepped off the boat. 1865 is the Emancipation Proclamation, which didn't really go into effect for months after that. Then you had the rise and birth of the Ku Klux Klan, the first wave of the Ku Klux Klan, which terrorized and lynched us. In addition to the various lynch mobs, you're from Florida, Cedric. So mm-hmm. Rosewood, let's talk Rosewood.
Yes.
Let's talk. And so then you think about the bombing of Black Wall Street in Oklahoma, but then also the Black Wall Street bombing in Durham. And the various other places of black commerce around the country. Then you talk about the Freedmen's Bank. And then we talk about the civil rights movement, dogs, fire hoses, billy clubs, all that kind of stuff. And then you go from there and you look at how our current state of gun control was because of the fear of black men with guns in California, namely the Black Panther Party. And then from there, crack. Crack. which you
know, bring a little bit of it.
Bring a little crack on it. You know,
crack on it.
You got the Sacramento Bee. There was a guy, I can't remember his name, he was a journalist that actually ended up committing suicide not too long in the not too distant past, who exposed the CIA funding the Nicaraguan Contras, who were selling drugs and smuggling drugs into the United States and giving them the freeway Ricky Ross, who became the biggest drug kingpin, who introduced crack to the whole rest of the country. And so the documentary Crack says that while the government did not sell or deliberately place crack into our communities, it did ignore the massive influx of drugs that were being smuggled into this country. And then what happened? When it got realized that crack was primarily a poor people's drug, they came up with those 1-to-100 laws. And we had these mandatory minimums, which some black preachers and black people in the country were clamoring for because it had gotten so violent. You cannot introduce something that powerful and that negative into an ecosystem and not expect there to be violence. And so you look at crack, and then think about the Tuskegee experiment back then. You think about that. The reason we're still saying Black Lives Matter, the fact that me, my father, and my grandfather are all veterans and went overseas to fight for this country and came home and got called nigger, is a problem. So there is literally no reason black people shouldn't get reparations. Now, what does it look like?
What does that look like? And that's the question.
Right? You ask 10 people, you get 10 answers.
Right.
Well, I want mine in a check form, and they can write how many answers they want.
And just to make sure I'm following up with the journalist who exposed the Nicaragua, I'm not saying it right, but it's Gary Stephen Webb.
Yep, Gary Webb. I remember, yeah.
Gary Webb, yep. Wow. So this is just blowing my mind on, because there's so many concepts here, because I definitely want to touch back, and we'll touch back to what does reparations look like. But that, do you think that reparations is tied to us wanting that privilege?
No. I think that reparations is tied to equaling the playing field. It takes three generations to build wealth. My grandmother's grandmother was a slave. My parents were literally living in government-sponsored, government-encouraged segregation. So literally, Gen X is the first generation, and not even that, to actually begin experiencing the fruits of the labor of the civil rights movement. Being a millennial, we are the ones who are trying to make the fruits of the civil rights movement become, you know, much greater and become literally that American dream that we were promised. You know, we were sold a bill of goods, and, you know, we're asking America to deliver. So I don't think it's rooted in privilege as much as it's rooted in equity across the board, you know, in finances, education, criminal justice, all of it. That's what we want.
Absolutely. So let's go back to what would reparations really look like? I know you said, Tim, you asked 10 people, it's going to look different. Said he wants his in the check. I want mine in the check too. I want mine in the check and a piece of property. So what do you think? You know, because I remember, you know, there's this little snippet in when Frederick Douglass was talking to Abraham Lincoln, and Abraham, you know, Senior saying, okay, well, what are we going to do with y'all? You know, I might let you go, but what y'all going to do? And Frederick Douglass just says, you know, you've done enough.
Yeah.
You've done enough, you know?
Thank you, but no thank you.
But no thank you. You've led us this far. And so I know that there is that quote unquote fear. If we give them money, they won't know what to do with it. They don't know how to handle themselves. I mean, look at them now. So when you think about reparations, what would that look like for us?
So I know a lot of people advocate cash payment. And I think for certain people, that is absolutely what's needed, with stipulations. Hear me out.
Okay.
So I think that those people who are at, I think that if you don't make enough to pay taxes and you're over the age of 21, I believe that you should be given a certain sum of money that is put away that can be used toward a house or a condo or something that will be a loan backed by the government. This is a privilege they give to every veteran with our VA loans. Mm-hmm. We don't have to have mortgage insurance. And a lot of these folks could get mortgages that are cheaper than their rent. Now, granted, some Section 8 rent is like ridiculously low, like $27. And I'm just
right.
like,
oh. Right. You can't beat that with
not
a bank.
Not up here.
Right.
But I think it's one of those things where I think that all two-year colleges and trade programs should be free for Black folks for a certain period of time. So that people can get retrained in certain things, and so that people can build, so that we can build a working class of skilled labor in this country. I think that, you know, Black people should get, it was another thing I was thinking about too. It was more so in terms of land. So if you make more than a certain threshold, you shouldn't necessarily be guaranteed a loan to buy your own home. But you should kind of get a little bit of leeway in terms of your credit score, which has been proven to have racial undertones to it as well. It should be easier. The path to home ownership should be easier. I'll just say that much for us as a result of the fact that we were denied the right to have homes. And think about it. The banking industry just paid all these fines, 8 years ago? because they were scamming Black and Hispanic folks. Yep. So it's one of those things. And also, I think that all Black, I think every HBCU grad should have their student loans forgiven. And now I went to a PWI, and so I'll take some student loan forgiveness too.
Right.
So we can spread that out a little bit to all Black, you know, graduates have their student loans forgiven. And I think we'll see a very powerful shift in this country with that. I think that when you get nobody that I know that, and I still know people that do this, nobody I know that sells drugs wants to sell drugs.
Yeah.
People in the hood don't want to be in the hood. They don't want to be strictly impoverished. It's just that they don't have the access and the mobility to go other places. They don't have the education to get out of there sometimes. They don't, trade programs ain't coming to schools in the hood.
Right.
Community colleges, no, they're not. And community colleges aren't being built in the hood. And so I think if we provide an opportunity for some of these guys to become welders, to become, brick makers,
plumbers,
electricians, yeah. All that, HVAC folks. And the Urban League does a lot of that stuff. The Urban League does it, but the Urban League needs help.
Right.
You know, and well, so it's one of those things where I think if we provide that opportunity for those folks that are in the hood, we'll start to see the hood shift.
Well, I'm a little bit older, so I remember when you could take welding, woodwork, and all that stuff in class. And then they also had a separate school where you can go to, and it was called a trade high school. You can go to high school, it's trade, but they lost funding and it just went away. And so, you know, I think you're absolutely right with those. The opportunities are so limited in what we do. So I appreciate our conversation. Man, you have a wealth of knowledge. I could talk to you like forever in a day. So, but what we're going to do, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to come back, and then we're going to get deeper into this conversation. We might have to break this thing down in about 50 different segments so you can get your shots off. So right now you got about 40, and it's just the first quarter. So we're going to bring Mr. Chad back. Welcome to the Colors of Relationship, and we'll be right back.
Be right back.
Empower Therapeutic Support Services, located in Minneapolis, Minnesota, specializes in providing multicultural, person-centered mental health services to diverse populations who are experiencing multiple life stressors. Empower offers individual, couples, family, and group services. If you are located in the St. Paul, Minneapolis area and would like more information about receiving services from Empower, please visit our link tree for access to their Facebook. You can also visit their website at www.empowerfam.com.
All right, so welcome back to the Colors of Relationships. I am your host, Dr. Asia King, along with
Cedric Weatherspoon.
And we have my homeboy, Chad, from Birmingham, Alabama, coming in, firing it off like bah, 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 bah.
Blessings on top of blessings.
I'm so blessed to have this man on, like, for real. But I want us, I need us to jump back a little bit. To the notion that Black folks just want to be treated like white people. That's all. We just want the same privilege as them. I mean, we could put our hand to our face and all that jazz, but is that really what we're saying, Chad? Is that we talk about it. Is it that we're getting it confused, that we're saying equality, but really we want the privilege?
I think some people want privilege. Truth be told, the only thing Black people have asked for in this country for hundreds of years now is to be treated fairly and left alone.
Mm.
That's the only thing we've literally asked for. Treat me right and leave me alone.
When the
only time I say treat me like a white person is when I get pulled over by the cops. Okay. That's it. Please treat me how you treat them. Okay. I've been pulled over a whole lot. Okay. Back in Birmingham, I got pulled over a lot. Now I'm a Black man that drives an orange Dodge Charger. So I already drive a drug dealer car and it's orange.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So I've been pulled over quite a bit, but it's one of those things where I've had some really cool interactions with cops. I've had some really, really bad interactions with cops too, which that's why it's like, you know, treat me like a white guy. You know, give me a chance. You know?
We're gonna let you go on this one. Lollipops.
Right. So I don't think it's so much that all of us want privilege as much as we want to be treated fairly. It's funny because, you know, a lot of white folks get upset and when we talk about equity and how black people aren't being treated fairly, the first thing that comes out of some people's mouth is, well, what about affirmative action? Mm. Affirmative action benefited white women more than any other demographic in the country.
How so?
They got those slots because it wasn't just for racial minorities. It was for gender minorities as well. It was for religious minorities. It was all that. And so when you talk about affirmative action, those women got points sometimes, and it was easier, like points per se in that situation. And they would look at him like, well, let's promote this one. Let's hire this one. And it was a study done not too long ago that said that white women were the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action. If you notice that every time somebody says something was benefiting white black folks, it's like, no, it was really created for a bunch of demographics. It's just that when America gets a cold, black America gets the flu. And so we ended up with the short end of the stick and had to use some of these programs. For example, I'll never forget this white guy here in Charlotte told me that he couldn't get food stamps because he was white. I was like, wait, what? He was like, yeah, I'm not working and yada, yada, yada. And I can't get food stamps and they're not going to give them to me because I'm white. I'm like, that is the strangest shit I've ever heard in my life. I'm sorry. I was like, excuse me. I was like, that is the strangest thing. But his name was Keith. I'll never forget. And I just kind of looked at him. I was like, Keith, are you crazy? But that was his thing. He felt so disenfranchised and kept blaming everything on the fact that black people had stuff and he didn't. And I was like, bro,
you wanna trade places?
and the thing is, I can't fault him for being mad. And here's why. A lot of these folks that you see at these rallies, you know, the Stop the Steal rallies. Now, the people that came to Washington, those people weren't poor.
Right.
Okay. Those people weren't disenfranchised. You go to your average rally like that in North Carolina, Alabama, Ohio, something like that, you will find some poor people there. And these people are angry because they think white privilege is a myth because they felt like they had to work for something. You know, they had to work for just a little bit that they got. But the thing is, you got an opportunity to work for that. And my friend over here didn't. And you got that opportunity because you were given it to, it was given to you because you're white. Whereas my friend over here never even had the opportunity to work that manufacturing job that you're upset left. And so it's one of those things where I would be mad, too, if I was promised an American dream and if I work hard, I can get out of something. And then on top of that, I have privilege and I'm still not living the American dream. Mm-hmm. So it's angst on top of angst. It's their economic and educational anxieties coupled with the fact that when they see people that don't look like them in power, it's like, they're afraid that somebody's going to take revenge on them for something that they feel they didn't do.
Hmm.
Wow.
Hmm. So
that's that, and that's such that's such a complicated and very deeply woven thinking and ideology. You know, that feeling of I'm supposed to have it.
Entitlement.
So then becoming envious and angry, not at the white folks that got it, but the folks that you think ain't supposed to have it. How do you have it? But I'm the one who's supposed to have it.
Right.
And so then it's as a therapist, it's always amazing to me that the trauma that we walk around with, you know, and when I hear and even seeing, you know, those folks, like you said, a lot of them now coming out, those weren't underprivileged white folks. Those were folks that had power. Those were folks who knew the ins and outs of the Capitol. They knew what was going on. But when I think about, you know, those subsets of folks that are in the rural counties and advocating and really fighting, and they're walking around with all this trauma, you know, privilege, trauma from lack of privilege.
Well, trauma from lack of resources.
But is it? Okay. So trauma from lack of resources. Okay. Okay. Even if they were given the opportunity to possibly get it as well. But you're saying like for those rural counties where they just won't get it even if they try because it's not there.
Yeah. So for example, the trailer park ain't no different from the trap.
Right.
Economically. They're both economically repressed areas with people who aren't given educational opportunities or career opportunities. Okay. And so when you see even when you see anybody outside of your area doing something on the TV, it seems so far away, but so close because you're like, well, I'm supposed to have that. Why didn't I get that? Whereas black folk are like, well, shoot, man, he must have worked hard. They're like, man, I don't see why I didn't get that. You know, I've heard it was crazy to me. I did a year of law school and there was this one guy who was in my class and he was very, very staunchly conservative. Which, you know, I don't mind. I have friends of all walks of life. But I overheard him make a comment that said, yeah, I came to this school because all the black people and women took up my spot at another locally prominent law school.
Hmm.
And I didn't let him know I heard it, but I saw him glance over at me and I was looking him in his eyes and he knew he had messed up. And the thing is, I walked up to him next week, and I was like, "Hey, man, just out of curiosity, what'd you get on your LSAT?" He told me what he got on his LSAT. I was 30 points higher than him. He couldn't have got in any other school. Period. So it's one of those things where you feel entitled to a certain amount of success. Because of what you see, and when you don't get it, you lash out at other folks.
Almost like misplaced rage. You're yep. mad at us, but we're not the ones who set you up to not have the resources. We're in the same boat, so actually we should be working together.
Well, that's why Martin Luther King was killed when he started the Poor People's Campaign and started getting the poor white folks together with the poor black folks. They was like, we got to stop this one. You know, we got to shut this brother down. Wow. And so you think about the Southern strategy, Nixon's Southern strategy, where they said, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than any black man, you can have his trust and his allegiance and all that. And that's essentially what we saw coming to full fruition with the siege on the Capitol and with the election of Donald Trump. We saw the Southern strategy play itself out in such a grandiose way that I sat back in awe. I was like, this is a sociology experiment.
It was.
It was fascinating. And Nixon was what, in the 60s? It took 50 years for that thing to blow all the way up. Can you see that as slow ticking time bomb that exploded and almost destroyed our democracy 50 years later? All because you planted the seed of an ideology in the heads of a large swath of people who were disenfranchised and undereducated. But they had heart and they had courage. And that's what we saw.
I think it's amazing that they were even able to gather together. And they did all this through technology. But yet, the FBI, they can tell when I'm rewiring my internet to my neighbor's house, but they can't catch when these folks were sitting up here trying to get a coup together. I find it very interesting. I'm just saying.
I mean, you know, most people ain't going to sleep on themselves.
I had to put this out here. You know, just sitting back listening to the conversation, it's like, dang, it seemed like we're all getting played. I mean, like, it seemed like everybody is getting played. You know, I had a friend of mine who used to say racism impacts everybody. And man, just listening to this conversation, I was like, man, we are getting, everybody is getting played. Who's running out the door with the bag? that's the part where I want to, I need to figure out who got the bag. Who's the puppet master?
The politicians, essentially. It's the politicians. And the thing is, and this is something that I'm actually going to write about next week, it's the politicians and the very, very prominent conservative clergy members in the country. Mm. One of my favorite stories in the Bible is when Satan takes Jesus to the top of the mountain and said, you know, you should throw yourself off of this mountain and see if the angel can come get you. He kept tempting God, Jesus. And then he also said that, you know, the last time he did it, he said, I'll give you all of this if you would just kneel and bow to me. And he said, nah, bow to my Father. I'm not bowing to you. And so it's fascinating thinking about that, as well as the 20 pieces of silver that Judas got for betraying Jesus. And I think about, you know, who was it? Was it Paula White talking about angels were coming from Africa to stop the election? And all of these conservative far right preachers and apostles and quote unquote prophets who made all these false prophecies in God's name, standing up there, and you look at them in these large, grandiose churches driving Bentleys and having private jets. And then you look at Mitch McConnell, who has the poorest area in Kentucky, but somehow manages to be a millionaire. You see all of this stuff, and you're like, man, these folks really getting checks.
Well, I mean, they said the evangelists, you know, the evangelists are the holders of, you know, those markets and who they market to. But it goes back to what? Government and religion. Mm-hmm. Government and religion. When you think on how this country was even not founded, but how they came over here was to run away from what?
Religious persecution. And they became the religious persecutors.
Well, that goes back to thinking like how do you really define freedom, and what does that mean, you know, for us as Black folks? You know, when they release a slave, we still haven't defined what that looks like. What is freedom? You know, what does freedom look like? Not so far as money, but what's the true essence of freedom?
I can't define that. And the reason I can't define that is because, much like Assata Shakur, I can't tell you much about freedom because I've never experienced it. I've experienced bondage and mental enslavement more than I've experienced freedom. Only now, literally in my 30s, am I becoming more acquainted with myself as a free Black man, a free thinking Black man, a free feeling Black man. I've always been unapologetically Black, but even that came within certain boundaries. And so it's one of those things where, you know, rejecting respectability and determining your own destination and demanding to be treated fairly as good as anybody else. Like, I can't tell you what freedom looks like. I can just tell you what I'm going to do to make myself feel free.
Mm. All right, man, Chad, promise me that when we have, I don't know, just when you have more time, you going to come back, right?
Yeah, I'll be back.
That we can come visit you at your show.
Yes.
I'll light it up on your show.
I'm actually restarting my podcast soon. I was supposed to restart it in this month. But I said, you know, I'm trying to move too fast. I'm trying to do too much. Let me sit down. I'm doing a full overhaul and rebrand of the show. It's called The Parlay Podcast. You can actually find it on you can find the page on Facebook. And on Twitter, you can find me on Call Me Parlay. And so it's one of those things where we're going to be having conversations with folks kind of like this, you know, week in and week out. I want to do like a 30-minute masterclass for folks on various topics. And so, but we're doing a full rebrand. You know, I got photos coming. I want to kind of do video. I'm just taking my time, putting some money behind it, putting some time behind it, and some real creative effort behind it to make it the best it can be, as opposed to just throwing it out there and asking people to listen. So,
I want to catch up.
Definitely got to come on.
Well, whatever you do, Chad, just know you've got our 100% support and our love and our dedication. I love you. And what we're going to do right now, y'all, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and, you know, I ain't got nothing else to say. And I'm going to just speak for Cedric. He ain't got nothing else to say either. So we're going to come back. Chad done already said when Black women rule the world. So I'm going to just
go. Oh, Lord.
So when we get back, Chad's going to do our 1 minute wrap up and just kind of tell us his takeaways and something that our audience can just kind of chew on until next show. So just hold tight. We'll be right back, guys. See you in a minute.
When Empower was created in 2007 by licensed marriage and family therapists Cedric Weatherspoon and Dominique Jones, they wanted to create a practice that not only supported people who came to therapy, but also addressed the issues that are often ignored by society, such as race, racism, and systemic oppression. Empire Therapeutic Services is committed to addressing these problems on a larger scale through reform, advocacy, and training. If you would like more information, visit their website, www.empowerfam.com, or visit our link tree for direct access to their Facebook.
All right. Welcome back, everybody, to The Colors of Relationships. I'm Dr. Asia King, along with
Cedric Weatherspoon.
Yep, and we have our guest, Chad, here, who, if you've been listening, I don't know. You know what? I hope that if you've been listening, you've been taking notes, you can follow Chad. Chad, tell folks where they can find you.
You can find me, of course, on Facebook, Chad Anthony. But I have a podcast that I'm relaunching soon called The Parlay Podcast. You can find it as The Parlay Podcast on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Call Me Parlay. That's going to be the official podcast Twitter as well. I produce Magic City Spotlight, which is the official podcast of the city of Birmingham. I'm on there producing with the mayor of Birmingham every week. I actually got to host this past episode talking about the future of technology in Birmingham. You can just catch me in traffic because I'm all over the place, or at a Harley dealership near you. So I'm everywhere.
There you go. So we want to give it to Chad. As you all know, our faithful and loving listeners, we do our 1 minute wrap up. And so we're just going to give it to Chad because I don't have nothing to really wrap up with. And he's been rapping this whole time. So let's just let Chad take it away. Chad, what is your 1 minute wrap up? What are the takeaways for our audience?
So we've talked about a lot of various things today, and we've done a little bit of digging into more than a few topics. The one thing I want to impress upon folks is that at the end of the day, all we have is each other. Mm. Without each other, this country would fall. Without each other, our families would fall. So I want to encourage everyone to not only love yourself fiercely and out loud and unapologetically, but love your neighbor. Because love is all we need. Yeah, it is all we need to overcome some of this stuff. And unless we really get to the root essence of love and start loving one another again, we're going to continue having these kind of problems and issues in this country. And, you know, a house divided against itself cannot stand. So eventually it's going to collapse. And so I just want you guys to love each other. Because I love you, and I haven't even met you, but I love you. And if you ever need anything, call your friends. Don't call me.
I love it. Love with conditions. I love it.
That's a boundary. I learned about it in therapy. Boundaries.
I love it. Well, thank you so much, Chad. I absolutely love and adore you. And this has just been amazing conversation. And you all, Cedric, tell everybody where they are able to find us and find our podcast as well.
Well, you can find us all over, but Buzzsprout is our main site. So go to Buzzsprout. You can link up to all the podcast sites that we're at. It's so many that we can't name, but our main one, we're on Spotify, we're on Google Play, we're on Audible. You can find us on Audible. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. Just put in a search bar, Colors of Relationships, and Dr. Asia and Cedric Weatherspoon, and our podcast will come up. And you can also find us on Facebook at Colors of Relationships. We're on Twitter, Colors of Relationship, and also on Instagram. We're kind of all over. We're kind of a thing right now. So we're past our 7 podcasts. So we're going to build our thing. So join us on this please step forward and listen. We have some exciting episodes. This is definitely one of them that I'm going to listen to about four times myself.
Absolutely. But thank you guys for listening. Share this with your family and friends, and we will see you next time. Go out in the world and be great. And most importantly,
be well.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Be sure to find us on Facebook at Colors of Relationships. Follow us on Instagram at The Colors of Relationships. And find us on Twitter at The COR Podcast.